Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a Category 5 Hurricane Maria devastated the independent island nation in the Caribbean, Dominica, last night. Hurricane warnings have been issued for other Caribbean islands, Guadeloupe, St. Kitts, and Nevis, St. Croix, which is part of the U.S. Virgin Islands, and also for Puerto Rico. Hurricane Maria also lashed Antigua, but did not make a direct hit there. Islands hit by Hurricane Irma will also feel the impact of Maria, with tropical storm winds and rain on a destroyed Barbuda and St. Martin, as well as the U.S. Virgin Islands. Our guest today is Shenzinzi Ra Kahini, who is based on St. Croix. And economist Max Wolf joins us to discuss the tax reform plan being touted by the Trump administration, as well as other budgetary implications of GOP bills, including the defense bill just passed the Senate, and now a new GOP health care bill stands a chance of slipping through the Senate, a vote without a score from the Congressional Budget Office. And Joy DeGruy, author of Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, joins us. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Hurricane Maria ripped into Dominica with 160-mile-per-hour winds today, ripping the roof off even the Prime Minister's residence and causing what he called mind-boggling devastation as it plunged into a Caribbean region already ravaged by Hurricane Irma. The storm was on track to hit Puerto Rico on Wednesday. Dominica Prime Minister Roosevelt Scarrett said on his Facebook page that initial reports are of widespread devastation and said he feared there would be deaths due to rain-fed landslides. Maria's eye roared over the island late last night. The storm briefly dipped to Category 4 strength early today before regaining Category 5 status. On the nearby island of Martinique, officials said about 25,000 households were without electricity and two small towns without water after Maria roared past. The islands of St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are in the storm's path. The New York Times is reporting that Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, has been told by federal prosecutors that they plan to indict him. The warning came after the FBI raided his home in July, reportedly picking the lock, although he was at home asleep. Agents sought proof he had set up offshore bank accounts. On Monday, it was confirmed Manafort had been wiretapped under a foreign intelligence warrant in connection with U.S. concerns that he was communicating with Russian operatives who wanted to influence the American election. The warrants were issued because Robert Mueller was appointed as special counsel to take over the investigation from the FBI. The U.S. government listened in on some of Manafort's conversations during the presidential campaign and through the election, and its surveillance includes the period when Manafort was Trump's campaign chairman. President Trump will make his debut address to the UN General Assembly today. He's expected to argue that nations should act in their self-interest, yet rally together when faced with a common threat such as North Korea. He plans to address other crisis points too, such as Iran's nuclear agenda, the instability in Venezuela, and the fight against terrorism in Syria and elsewhere. Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire told CNN that Trump's isolationist tendencies are worrying.
I hope he will talk about the importance of American leadership in the world. We know that's what countries across the world are looking for. And when we don't continue our leadership position, then countries like China and Russia and other rogue nations step in.
Trump frequently belittled the UN as a candidate, and his White House has been infused with forces that believe the UN acts as a global bureaucracy and infringes the sovereignty of nations. But Trump is expected to argue that UN member states should unite to face global dangers. The UN says Rohingya Muslims are quite literally being wiped off the map in Myanmar. After attacks by Muslim militants last month, thousands of homes were burned in Rohingya enclaves of the predominantly Buddhist nation. More than 500,000 people, roughly half their population, fled to neighboring Bangladesh in the past year, most in the last 3 weeks, and they are still leaving. The Rohingya's plight has been decried as ethnic cleansing. Myanmar's civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi expressed doubt today about the cause of the migration.
There have been no clearance operations. Nevertheless, we are concerned to hear that numbers of Muslims are fleeing across the border to Bangladesh. We want to find out why this exodus is happening.
The Arakan Project, which works to improve conditions for the ethnic minority, is documenting attacks on 3 Rohingya townships. Satellite imagery released by Human Rights Watch today shows swaths of scorched landscape and the near-total destruction of 214 villages. California lawmakers have passed a package of immigration protection bills in resistance to the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement policies. They include a sanctuary state bill, a measure to limit immigration raids at workplaces, a bill to prohibit landlords from using a tenant's immigration status against them, and another to fight a possible Muslim registry. Christopher Martinez reports.
Angela Chan is policy director of Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus. Chan, like other immigrant rights activists, hopes that the bills will send a message to the federal government and to other states.
Over the long run, over decades, it's more likely that the left-leaning states are going to make the most progress and are going to move some of these swing states to adopt policies that are more inclusive and are more welcoming.
The immigrant protection bills are now awaiting action by Governor Jerry Brown. Chan is optimistic Brown will sign the bills. After all, he helped broker deals that included amendments that weakened several of the measures from what advocates had wanted. But then there's the question of what happens after Brown leaves office.
I think it'll be a question as to whether or not our next governor will be bolder on immigrant legislation, or if he or she is going to continue to walk the same line as Brown, which is to oftentimes reach compromises on the bills between immigrant rights advocates and opponents, including, for example, the Sheriff's Association.
Governor Brown has until October 15th to sign or veto bills on his desk. On the State Capitol Beat, I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Monday night and Tuesday morning, Hurricane Maria wreaked havoc across the Caribbean with winds as high as 165 miles per hour. And further to the north, Hurricane Jose is showing up on the northeast coast with raging surf and damaging winds. After making landfall on the island of Dominica, Maria strengthened to the highest level Category 5, the first in recorded history for that island. On Monday, the storm cut across not only Dominica, but also Martinique, Guadeloupe, and St. Lucia, where hurricane warnings were in effect. It is also approaching the U.S. Virgin Islands, including St. Croix, expected to hit St. Croix, and Puerto Rico as a Category 5. Maria is predicted to mostly pass through part of the Caribbean that's free of islands before hitting St. Croix, which is now under a hurricane warning. Dominica's prime minister said the hurricane brought widespread devastation and that the islanders had lost all what money can buy and replace, and indeed his roof was blown off. Let us go now to a clip from CNN talking about the hurricane in the Caribbean region.
Hurricane Maria, Category 5, has just made landfall on Dominica. A prime minister posting to his Facebook page, "My roof is gone. I am at the complete mercy of the hurricane. House is flooding." A short time later, an update, "I have been rescued." I want to get the latest now from meteorologist Allison Chinchar in the CNN Weather Center. So where is the storm? What's the latest tonight?
Right. So again, as you mentioned, it has now officially made landfall at 9:15 p.m. Eastern Time. as a Category 5 storm, winds 160 miles wow. per hour. The storm is moving west-northwest at about 9 miles per hour, so not very fast, which unfortunately means it's just going to go slowly over the island of Dominica. But we need to talk about how impressive this storm actually is and how quickly it intensified, okay? This is Sunday at 5 p.m. Winds were just at 75 miles per hour, so this is when it first became a hurricane, okay? So going at 5 p.m., to 8 p.m. tonight, going from a tropical storm all the way up to a Category 5 storm. Or even this morning, take for example 5 a.m., it was still a Category 1 storm. 5 a.m. to 8 p.m., going from a Category 1 to a Category 5 storm. The unfortunate part about it being a Category 5 storm is it is expected to stay a Category 5 storm. In fact, it's expected to increase up to 165 miles per hour after it gets back out over some open water. It is expected to make landfall on Puerto Rico as a Category 5 storm. Now, the question is whether or not it maintains that 165 mile per hour range or if it weakens slightly just before it hits Puerto Rico. That's important, that distinction is, because the previous Category 5 storm, and there's only been one to ever hit Puerto Rico, that was back in 1928, but it had winds of 160. So if it can maintain winds of 165, it will end up being the strongest storm to ever hit the island of Puerto Rico. The last time they had a Category 4 was back in 1932. That was the last direct strike of a Category 4 or higher. Again, this is going to be an incredibly strong storm as it continues on this track.
All righty. So that source for that clip, CNN. I would now like to welcome our guest, Dr. Shenzira Kahina, Director of the Virgin Islands and Caribbean Cultural Center, Director of the Center for Spirituality and Professionalism, and a visiting Assistant Professor of Communications at the University of the Virgin Islands. She is based in St. Croix. Dr. Shenzira, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And I want to just clear up some things. I like to focus on what I do primarily at the University of the Virgin Islands, which is serve as the director of the Virgin Islands Caribbean Cultural Center and as the advisor for the WVI radio station, which is a student-operated initiative through the College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences, because I like to keep it tight. I want to thank you for just giving us an opportunity to just share. Originally, we thought we were going to be focusing on relief and recovery efforts following Hurricane Irma devastation to the region, yeah? And now we're preparing, and the rains have already started, the winds have already picked up here on the beautiful island right now of St. Croix, and we're really praying that the damages are at a minimum, because this is the one island within the Virgin Islands of the U.S. that has not been devastated in the hurricane season currently. So I'm really appreciative of being able to share just some of the shifts now, because everything has went from relief and recovery to preparation and just survival, just making sure that persons are safe, making sure persons are secure, and making sure that the efforts of whether it's through federal support or global support, which has been pouring in from a variety of locations and persons, we really would like for persons to just know that we're doing our best to remain safe and, of course, strong.
Right. Well, we're glad to be able to get through to you, because a curfew is now being established, because now Maria is scheduled to hit St. Croix. We're being told. Is that still the forecast? And do you have any idea about when that would happen?
Yes. Well, they're anticipating that the winds have already started. The curfew was in effect as we speak. So there's a curfew from 10 this morning, and it's going to be strengthened as such until after the storm. And the governor of the Virgin Islands, Kenneth Mapp, has already presented several press conferences that have given statements that are very, very specific in regards to persons that are in already damaged portions of the Virgin Islands to secure more appropriate shelter, whether it's to go to the shelters that have been listed in respective islands or to go, you know, with family and more secure locations. Several of the evacuees from St. John, our sister island of St. John, as well as St. Thomas, have already been transported to St. Croix because of Hurricane Irma damages that, you know, really impacted more than 80% of the structures and the infrastructure in St. John and St. Thomas, as well as our isle that is within the water island. So we're really focusing right now on making sure that the persons that have been relocated here are safe, and we're making sure that we can have as much information together so that persons can survive between now and Thursday morning.
Yeah, you know, this is just so frightening. I'm from the Caribbean region myself. I'm from Barbados, mm-hmm. as my listeners know. And if category 565 mile per hour wind hit our island, basically it would decimate the place. So likely we would be in a similar state to St. Martin. And St. John, and I think St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands, those were the two very badly hit, right? But they were hit with winds at about 145 miles per hour. Right now, we're talking about Hurricane Maria at 165 miles per hour hitting your home island where so many people fled, as you said, from St. John and St. Thomas. It's a very, very precarious situation.
Right. I think that one of the reasons I can probably sound really calm, and I'm going to share it based on what was shared with us by another one of your country nationals, the Honorable Dr. Myrna Belgrave. And she said there's been a shift in the cosmos, and it's affecting everyone on all or one of our levels of existence, mental, physical, social, financial, and spiritual. And that this global warming is our warming also. We have an inner nature as well. We are 72% water, 12% earth, 6% air, 6% ether, and 4% fire. And
right.
Let's harmonize the inner nature with the outer nature. And I share that because it's that kind of spiritual reinforcement. And, of course, many persons are praying, meditating, doing affirmations, just staying focused and working. The type of community, you know, irrespective of some of the commentary that, you know, criminal elements and persons looting, et cetera, and so forth and so on, that has a lot to do with desperation and just persons' behavior and continence even before the storm.
Yeah, and it also has to do with basic lack of basic necessities, food and water.
Exactly.
Dr. Shenzira, hold your thought because I'd like to welcome another guest. I'd like to welcome back Dorbreen Omard, a recognized cultural worker throughout the Caribbean region. He's based in Antigua. He's an author, a playwright, director, producer of theater, music, also a journalist and calypso writer, judge, and analyst. Dorbreen, welcome back. I mean, who knew, Dorbreen, that we would be back again discussing with you yet another hurricane? Welcome back.
Thanks so much, Margaret. I really wish it was to discuss something else. So let me take this opportunity to say hello to Shenzira, to Dr. Chen, Davis Corona, who is also a very good friend of mine.
Okay, very good. Now, what is the situation in Antigua right now? You didn't get a direct hit, is that right? But you definitely felt
You didn't get.
Go on, Dorbreen. Oh, dear. Yeah, and I think we're having trouble with his phone line. Let us try to reach Dorbreen. Let's try to get him back on the line. But Dr. Chen, is that how you're known in the region?
Right.
Yeah.
You just call me Dr. Chen or Mama Chen, yeah.
Okay. All righty. So one of the things that we here on Sojourner Truth have talked about quite a bit is the concern about the double standard in the value of human life. And we see that in the response, certainly, to the hurricanes. I mean, when you look at, for example, in the U.S., you really don't see a whole heck of a lot about the hurricanes in the Caribbean region, even the U.S. Virgin Islands. You all are a part of a U.S. territory. When you contrast that with Harvey in Florida, which, of course, you know, got a lot of coverage, and well, it should. But I also don't think the Caribbean region should be ignored. And even though aid, as you say, is coming in from around the world, it still when you contrast the assistance that people on the mainland in the United States are getting, there definitely is a difference. And also the concern for the Caribbean region that are not territories of the United States, you know, or some other colonial power. It's almost like the clash of the colonial powers and Africans who were brought over to those islands, and this being played out and how things are working with these hurricanes. And I just wanted your thoughts on that, and even the whole thing about people looting, where you have people trying to survive in St. Martin. You know, even, you know, I heard a story of somebody being attacked because they had water. They had a six pack bottle of water, Dr. Chen.
Right. Well, there's been a number. Okay. That's why it's important to always come back to like that spiritual center, because a lot of what has happened here, and perhaps on St. Croix, persons that have lived here over the last 20 plus years, this is also on the anniversary of Hurricane Hugo devastating St. Croix. You know, more than 90% of the infrastructure was damaged, right? And it was just, and it impacted the entire region. And, you know, St. Croix is still recovering even from that particular storm that happened in 1989. So, and it was a Category 5, and they couldn't even measure because it was in excess of 165 miles per hour. So there's a lot that's going on in the minds of persons that are here in St. Croix in particular, and in the region. And I would be remiss if I didn't include we speak of the United Virgin Islands. We do our best not to just speak of Virgin Islands, U.S., Virgin Islands, British, because we're all one Caribbean, we're all one United family, right? So Tortola, Virgin Gorda, Jos Van Dyke, Anegada experienced significant damage. The damages in Tortola are seeming, it changed the complete landscape of the region. And so, of course, you're going to have persons that out of desperation, and because it was a lack of immediate responsiveness, you know, within, you know, some persons did not have contact with anyone for more than 72 hours. You understand, there were no relief resources that prioritized the nationals, and I want to be specific, the native, indigenous, ancestral persons living in some of these islands were not attended to expeditiously. Yeah?
Yeah.
The focus had been on persons that needed, you know, health care supports, which we fully understand.
And also tourists, getting the tourists out.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. And, you know, so we had, you know, certain naval ships, naval troops, I should just say military troops that came forward, you know, and especially here because the Virgin Islands, U.S., is a non-incorporated, non-self-governing territory of the U.S., there's a different flavor for how the rescue, relief, and recovery efforts have been engaged. So, like, in speaking to persons or getting texts from persons that are on St. John, for example, which is one of our smallest of the Virgin Islands, U.S., they were devastated. You have persons that were able to get off, you know, because of, you know, they have the resources to get off. And some persons, you know, they had persons that were going to come for them in helicopter, et cetera, but it wasn't geared for the common local population. So that's starting to be exposed now. And again, not to create any kind of discontent with the forces that were supportive, but we have to call a spade a spade.
Absolutely.
And that's what kind of, you know, has been going on here. You know, we've got persons that have been relocated, you know, from their homes, and granted, they've been destroyed. However, persons are concerned because, you know, the few little items they have left are in these well-exposed places, and the level of security has not been put in place. You do have persons out of their own desperation. And of course, if you know the big house up on the hill is mashed down and you don't have nothing but splinters, you're going to walk up the road and you're going to look for something to survive for your family. And persons, you know, the level of security needs to be more compassionate. I think that's what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah.
Persons need not be seeing the military, or I should be more specific, the military should come with a form of human compassion, because these are persons that are in serious shock and trauma, which I'm sure, you know, later on in your program, that'll be detailed in more specificity. But I'm just saying the trauma that has been experienced, the psychological as well as the physical trauma here, and this is happening after already being under an economic trauma before the storms. I want to highlight that for persons that already had struggle and strife and all kinds of discrimination and issues going on before the storm, this is just strengthening all of these issues of concern. So, you know, you have persons that are concerned about their land and property. They're concerned. You have persons rolling up to people that are standing next to the splinters of their home and all their belongings, and you have persons coming and offering people cash in the middle of a storm. You understand what I'm saying? Mm. I'm saying we can buy your land from you right now.
Wow.
And we'll help you get off the island right now. I mean, that's the kind of, I call them hurricane speculators. You understand?
Yeah.
They move with a different attitude. They're not moving in a human, compassionate form. So, you know, we're really encouraging persons to just, you know, hold on. You know, we're doing our best to share. That's the time I really...
Don't sell your land and don't sell your house. Shanzira, we are, Dr. Chen, running out of time. I want to talk with you again, though, because there's so much coming out from what you're saying, and it's bringing so much back, because I lived through a major hurricane in Barbados, and I grew up in something called a chattel house. You know, a chattel house in Barbados, right?
Yeah.
It's not what we would call a wall house, a house built of stone. The kind of hurricane that you all are expecting would have destroyed not only our house, but most of our village. So it's a little emotional listening to what you're talking about, because I exactly know what that is and understand also that people, when you go through that kind of experience, you're suffering a kind of a PTSD, post-traumatic syndrome, and then to have military people come in and the U.S. media, you know, portraying you as just a pack of looters is just outrageous. But Dr. Chen, I am going to post on our website ways in which people can help your community. I also have another list of where people who want to help to support people in the Eastern Caribbean, not necessarily the Red Cross, because we've had a lot of problems with the Red Cross in relation to Haiti and also following Hurricane Katrina. So, Dr. Chen, we hope that you stay safe, okay? And I'm going to check in with you later and see how you're doing and organize when you could come back on our show and tell us about some of what you only got the tip of the iceberg, began to discuss with us about what's going on in these Caribbean islands.
Thank you so much. And to your listeners, just keep us in prayer so that we can stay firm, strong, and live through this successfully, you know, and just keep us in your prayer. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Mama Chen. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we are now going to be shifting gears. We are delighted to have back with us economist Max Wolf. And Max Wolf, chief economist at Disruptive Technology Advisors, a market strategy consultant at 55 Capital, a writer in the areas of international finance and macroeconomics, teaches economics at the New School University Graduate Program in International Affairs. And he's also seen on BBC, NPR, Al Jazeera, Bloomberg TV. His work has been on the Wall Street Journal and many other outlets. Max, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Max, there is so much going on, and I'll have to say I got a little upset just listening to the sister talk about what is going on in the Caribbean region, and I can't even imagine the level of resources that it will really take to rebuild these economies. And meanwhile, here in the United States, the Trump administration pushing this tax reform. And surprisingly, apparently both Republicans and Democrats are in the mix. But we're not hearing a whole heck of a lot about the tax plan. We are hearing, though, that the rich, on the one hand, is supposed to gain from this tax plan, but Trump is also saying to the press that the rich will not be gaining at all with this plan. What do you know, or any analysis you can give us? Break any of this down for us.
Sure. Well, I think we know more about the rebuilding from the natural disaster, which isn't much, but more than we know about what the tax plan will look like. And I'll give you three reasons for that. One, various and mutually exclusive attributes have been sort of thrown at this tax plan. So we've been told, hey, here's some basic facts about the tax plan. it will be only relief for lower-income people. Then another one, here are some basic facts about this tax plan. It will lower capital gains tax, and it will lower estate taxes, which are absolutely useless to reducing the tax on low-income people. And then we've also been told that it'll be across-the-board tax cut focused on lower-income people. So those three things are each mutually exclusive with each other. And then, you know, not to be too skeptical here, but the truthfulness of past announcements from the White House and some members of Congress also would leave us in a position to be wise to be a little bit skeptical about whether what materializes will be what has been advertised. So we haven't received much information, and we'd have to heavily discount the information we have received. It does look like there'll be a tax cut. It does look like there'll be a meaningful reduction in the corporate income tax in the United States from 35%, which is the sort of de jure, the legal number now, to something probably closer to 25%, which is, you know, very meaningful reduction. And that will increase the amount of profits that firms can keep as opposed to distribute to the federal government. That will also, of course, have effects on the revenues of the federal government and will probably aggravate planned cuts, which will come to social programs, perhaps, if what we've seen in the budget materializes. So what we do know is that we were already facing some probably generationally large cuts in social programs in the U.S., and those would probably be increased by the tax cuts, whoever gets the tax relief, only because tax cuts always kind of equate to less revenue in the pockets of the federal government to fund all kinds of things. And we saw yesterday the passage of a commitment to increase funding on military and homeland security. So residually, that means all these discretionary programs, including most of the social benefits outside of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, face significant cuts.
Right. And just I don't have the figures in front of me here, Max, but I know some data came out recently to that was really bad news for my community, for Black people in the United States who remain, you know, at the bottom. Again, you see the kind of racial divide in all of this. And when they're talking about who benefits from the tax plan, you know, increased profits from corporations. Hopefully there will be some relief for people considered, you know, middle class. But we, as you say, we know that the threatened cuts in social programs will even further devastate communities. So I don't know. I really don't see a silver lining in any of this in terms of what's coming out of the Trump administration and what it will mean for people, you know, sitting at their kitchen table, like I know I do, you know, trying to figure out how you're going to pay the bills, eat, and pay your rent. Max Wolf.
Yeah, so look, I think part of the issue here is we could hope that a reduction in corporate taxes, which sometimes happens, although it's hard to predict and it's in no way guaranteed, we could hope that that would translate into a little bit more appetite for hiring folks, and that would be good in terms of employment. Although we've seen the employment headline numbers recover, we haven't seen the labor force participation recover. In other words, the amount of the society, the portion of society that's in the formal labor force has declined. That looks like a structural rise in the informal economy, which is probably dangerous for social equality long-term or even social stability. But we have seen the unemployment rates at least come very far down, you know, well below 5%, which is positive. But we've seen wages be very stuck. So wages are probably the bigger issue right now for a lot of Americans than employment, although that remains a challenge for many. I think the other way to think about it is, even if you're out there and you will receive a tax cut of some kind, the question is, what cut in services will you receive, and will you be left better off as an individual, and what cut in services to your community will occur, and will the community be better off? So even if you do get a tax cut, if you also receive a lot of government services or subsidized goods and services from the federal government, and those are cut, you could easily find yourself worse off. And the reason I bring this up is we've largely been conditioned to look only at what we pay for our government and not to think about what we get from the government. It's very not in vogue to think about that. But the truth is that whether it's paved roads or airports or national security or the armed services or fire and natural disaster relief or FEMA or the National Atmospheric and Oceanic groups that are tracking and let us know about these storms to make their devastation less likely to result in loss of life, there's actually a lot that we do get separate and apart, even from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that we do actually get from the federal government. And when we start cutting these things, even if we do get a tax cut, it becomes important on the community level as well as on the individual level to figure out not just what you get back in the extra $130 a month or whatever it works out to be, but if you get $130 a month and you lose fire, police protection, and public health infrastructure, it'd be kind of hard to imagine you'd buy that back with the $130 a month.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, you mentioned the disasters here. You know, the theoretical basis of people like Paul Ryan, you know, a fan of Ayn Rand and, you know, her philosophy of selfishness, basically looking out for number one, also is against what they describe as, quote unquote, big government. Right. And one wonders that with Harvey hitting in Houston and then Florida being hit with Irma, if some of the Trump supporters who are opposed to big government, they're some of the first ones lining up to get help from FEMA. So you're right to underscore what people, you know, get from paying taxes. But the other thing, too, though, when you look at, I think it was the defense bill just went through the Senate, $700 billion, more money than what Trump asked for. And then you've got this Graham, I don't remember the other senator that's going in with Graham now on this new health care bill. A lot of people thought that the GOP health care bill was dead. Well, it's not. It's alive and well in the Senate, and it's sounding as though it has a good chance of slipping through. But they want to do the vote without any rating from the Congressional Budget Office. So when one looks at the economy, you also have to look at how else, you know, where else the money is going. If you look at defense, right? And who knows what the cost of this, it's the Graham Cassidy bill. Who knows what the cost of this Graham Cassidy bill is going to be? And all of that impacts all of us.
Sure. So we've seen in the past, it's a bit unusual that a Republican president with a Republican House and a Republican Senate has been largely unable to pass the marquee legislation. So that wouldn't have been anyone's baseline assumption. It's a bit counterintuitive and surprising. So I don't know if we should be surprised that some legislation is eventually passed. I mean, that should have more or less been the baseline assumption, I think. To wit, we would also add that part of the issue in the past with other attempts to repeal Obamacare or the actual Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare, has been that the constituents of a lot of the folks who are in leadership in the House and Senate will be disproportionately negatively affected. So this is actually a case study in being hostile to government services while also being dependent on them. And the other thing we haven't heard a lot about is that employment related to the Affordable Care Act and to medical jobs in lots of regions, particularly the red states, has been a large source of community success. So not just the obvious provision of healthcare, which is hugely important, but also really massive amounts of federal and state investment in the community and jobs. And so I think there's become a fear that a lot of folks who had voted in past attempts to repeal, at least in name, knowing that they would not go through, you know, under President Obama, the Affordable Care Act, are now a little bit nervous about having to live within their communities if they do actually repeal the legislation they may have run on repealing. And this might be a great, great case study in sometimes the rhetoric doesn't match the underlying economic reality.
Right. And who knows, too, we'll see if they're actually going to reduce the tax bracket for the wealthiest down to 35%. Apparently, the New York Times is reporting that Trump is now considering keeping the tax bracket for the wealthiest Americans, you know, pretty much where it is. But just finally, we have to wrap it up, Max. I was really quite struck. Bloomberg has an article about the world's biggest wealth fund hits $1 trillion. Of course, this is Norway. And it's really ironic because they've got healthcare in Norway. They've got an amazing education system in Norway, you know, healthcare as a right in Norway. I mean, all of the things that in the United States, they would say, well, that's socialism. What Norway doesn't have is they're not passing a budget for $700 billion in defense, right? So, you know, because when you look at human needs, we're always told, well, the funds just isn't there. But I think that that thing in Norway, and they're, by the way, having trouble finding where to invest this $1 trillion, you know, revenue that they have coming in.
Yeah, so the Norges Bank, which is the sovereign wealth fund, largest in the world, which is sort of the Norway common fund, is also interesting for another reason. So it was started in 1996, and the idea was that the oil wealth that the country, already wealthy before the oil was discovered, should be both, was recognized as unsustainable environmentally, and just there's a finite amount of oil. And the idea was to collectivize the benefit of that natural resource by putting it basically into a trust for the future of Norway. And the Norges Bank is, in fact, a government-run trust that takes the revenue from selling that oil, and to your point, invests that revenue, and looks to use that revenue for posterity to support Norway, particularly to support Norway when the economy is bad. And it was tapped for the first time a few years ago to allow social welfare payments to stay up in a weak economy,
yeah,
but also to build on a future when the oil will run out, and make sure that future generations don't lose from the all the revenue being consumed by previous generations as we cut taxes and increase spending, probably yet again. That's Norway has reached the $1 trillion mark, doing the opposite of what our budget now seeks to do to our children and their children.
Right. Well, Max Wolf, I'm sorry really to have to leave it there. And we hope that you'll be able to join us yet again soon. We appreciate your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Take care.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott. We're going to take a short station break, and delighted to say that Joy DeGruy, yes, Joy DeGruy is waiting to speak with us. Late, great Bob Marley coming in from the cold. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And you can check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a friend of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Delaware. Let's remember Delaware. And we are delighted now to welcome Dr. Joy DeGruy. We've talked quite a bit on this show about Dr. Joy DeGruy's work, her path-breaking work on post-traumatic slave syndrome. She's updated her book. There's a new edition of the classic post-traumatic slave syndrome. And Dr. Joy challenges all of us, from challenging those who say chattel slavery and its aftermath is old history and should be put behind us, to uncovering and drawing out truth about what many would prefer to keep hidden. The impact of chattel slavery still not on the descendants of those enslaved, but also on people who are not descendants, indeed on the entire society. Dr. Joy DeGruy holds a Bachelor of Science degree, a Master's degree in Social Work and Psychology, as well as a PhD in Social Work, decades of experience, and she also has worked with numerous academic institutions, including Harvard, Yale, Oxford, Morehouse, Fisk, and many others. Dr. Joy DeGruy, welcome.
It is wonderful to be here.
Okay. Dr. Joy, I'm speaking with you within the context now. This is post-Charlottesville. Even as we speak, there were 3 days of people just protesting there in St. Louis as yet another police officer got off from killing a black man. And I just want to share a short clip and then get some response from you from Alicia Garza. She is one of the founders of Black Lives Matter.
When we look at this 2016 outcome, clearly something's broken. But what does that say about the larger question of whites and blacks working together and other non-white Americans, is common cause still possible? Can we come to a place of pushing progress forward? And if so, how?
I mean, it's a simple but complicated question. The basic answer is we have to figure out how to do it. But the complication in it is the question of for what. And so, of course, I think that if there is to be a functional democracy in this country, then we have to figure out what connects us, and we have to stop being afraid of what is different about each of us. And I use the word afraid very intentionally. I don't use it flippantly. I think that fear is something that really drives the Trump agenda. It drives Trumpism, and it drives really this notion that somebody's out to get what you deserve, and they're getting things that they don't deserve, they're not working hard enough for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is really what has consolidated people around things that don't actually make any sense in terms of saving our lives, saving the life of the planet, or creating a world that is more equitable. The other thing I think gets in the way, though, is that we tend to not go deep enough in terms of a few places. One, I just mentioned in my earlier answer, which is I think we still have a lot of reckoning to do with how we came to be. And part of what happens is that we erase the genocide of indigenous people. We erase the enslavement of African people in this country from the narrative of how we got here. And so that means that it results in a narrative of who we are that is a lie. It's just false. And until we start to look that in the face with courage and bravery, we're not going to move very far.
Well, Dr. Joy DeGruy, listening to that, and the source for that is The Nation magazine. It sounds like she's read your work, right?
Well, you know, I certainly hear the same and point and agree emphatically with her. I'm very happy to see younger people out there, you know, really speaking truth, you know, speaking truth, because that's exactly right what she's saying. We cannot look at America's current situation outside the construct of our history. And there is this kind of consistent, you know, like mythology. I know that Peggy McIntosh calls it this whole idea of the myth of meritocracy. And that's a myth that every individual is the only unit, the actual individual, the only unit of a society, that whatever happens for that one unit of society, that individual, has to have been the result of what he or she wanted, worked for, or what he or she earned, or what they deserved. And it rests on this assumption that how people feel and think, how they behave, what they're capable of accomplishing, are not influenced by any social system or circumstance. That's the myth of meritocracy. And so you do have folks that go, well, you know, we earned it. And, you know, they wouldn't have to look very far to figure out they didn't earn it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's a fundamental assumption that people just have and keep. And I think she's also very, very right that we don't have a lot of options here. We have to figure this out. You know, and the reason is because we won't have a country. This is not going to go away. And folks are not today, youth and children and adults, are not willing to accept antiquated systems that are unjust and inequitable. So we have to know that, you know, there are plenty of folks on both sides who say, you know, if I can't have it, then you can't either. Right.
Yeah.
So that, and that breeds a whole nother set of behaviors and kinds of potentials for real major clash. But we do. We have to work together. And I am of that opinion. I'm right there with her. We have to do this. This is not an option. We got to figure out how to work through this, and we have to figure out how to do that together.
Dr. Joy, I have watched many times the talk you gave, an event Sojourner Truth hosted at Holman United Methodist Church, because it is so rich, and I try to play clips from it as much as possible. But one of the things you talked about in this whole thing about cognitive dissonance, but also the lack of empathy. And you describe how in the lynching days, you know, a whole family would show up to watch the lynching and the impact that that has. I mean, not only this horrors, the impact on Black people and descendants of enslaved, but also on white people. Like, what does that mean for them, Dr. Joy?
Yes. You know, I think it's like anything else. You have to, and for those who are your listeners, you know, many of us have been around folks who normalize trauma. Like if you go and you'll see children and they'll see something, a car accident or someone's been shot, but their affect, their behavior is almost excitement. It's the opposite of what it should be. It's called an inappropriate affect. Well, imagine, you know, whole family after church going to view someone being lynched. You know, what do you do with that? You have to then normalize that behavior. And for a child, which is a horrific thought, or even, you know, you have to then look at that person. It's not a whole person. Otherwise, what is mom and dad, and what are we as people that we would do this to another person? So what they do is they find a way to say it's not that bad for them. And in order to do that in that context, you have to, you know, in effect, dehumanize them and to allow yourself to manage the trauma. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, especially for children, they're going to go, oh, well, they're not like us. And if you start looking at, you know, you come to my training or read the book, you realize that it actually has translated into the literature. Or even in medicine, you read Harriet Washington's work, where people stopped believing we felt pain. Even to 2017 research that looked at physicians and medical people who really believed we didn't feel pain on the same level as, you know, we don't feel pain on the same level as white people. And I think all of this comes from this way of trying to normalize a tragedy and to somehow minimize our humanity. So I think the ultimate piece is you have folks who can't feel it. They can't feel it because for generations they've been taught and it's been modeled, you don't have to feel anything for them. So it shouldn't surprise us that we see this lack of empathy or embrace. And, you know, that, and again, that gets stacked up in the DNA. And so we, the good news, you know, I tell everyone, the good news is that we can change that trajectory. We can change it, but we can't change it if we don't look at it, if we don't acknowledge it. We can't change those feelings and thoughts and behaviors and ideas until we know better. And where we are is we keep denying and refusing to address this big old ugly boil, and it's festering and it's becoming infected. And when it bursts, it's going to spill on everything.
That's right. And we just really have a minute or so, but I saw that a student was killed, a white student was killed by police at a university. I don't have the name of the university in front of me, and there were some protests yesterday, and three people were arrested. And Dr. Joy, I was just thinking that of when we think of all of the young Black people who've been killed in the protests going on now in St. Louis, you know, that people think, well, that's happening to somebody else. That's happening to Black folks. But, you know, when people start, you know, behaving in this way, then it can trickle up. I don't know about trickle down, but things do trickle up in that way. Just a quick final comment from you, Dr. Joy.
I think that, you know, always say this to people. You know, after the third day of the of my talk is going to actually be in the community, and a really dear friend of mine is bringing a theater production of Henry Box Brown, which is a story, a true story, based on the true story. It's a musical, but it's based on the true story of a man, an enslaved African man whose family was sold, and he then actually mailed himself to freedom. But
wow.
The reason why I'm, that becomes a very important piece is I think we should show up in community.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be asking everyone for my conference to show up at that play and to be part of the talk back that's going to happen after the play with community, with folks who don't have a clue, to folks who are very informed, to people who I don't know what the response will be. But we have to learn how to stay in the room. So I guess my final word is, the only way to deal with this is if we stay in the room. Doesn't matter. We don't all have to agree on everything. But we have to agree on some fundamental things, that each one of us has a right to move and live in the world and be treated with respect and dignity. We don't have to agree on everything, but we have to agree on our intrinsic worth and humanity. And then we can begin to move forward, but not if people get in their feelings and leave the room. We got to stay in the room. This is us. This is ours. And this is the inheritance of our children.
Dr. Joy, in these troubled times, you know, we need your voice more than ever. And I know how busy you are, but I hope you don't mind. We're going to be pursuing you again very, very soon to be on the show and hopefully have a bit more time with us. We appreciate you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your work. We are out of time. Thank you for listening. Thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. I am going to be traveling a few days for yet another family funeral, sadly, but we've prepared some wonderful material for you. So keep tuning in to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.